back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, here with Sean Blackman. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we are continuing the show here, talking some about how data, algorithms, IT, and all of that is feeding into the school-to-prison pipeline, among other things. And we are very happy to be joined, as we continue the conversation, by Marika Pfefferkorn, who is the co-founder of the Coalition to Stop the Cradle-to-Prison Algorithm Coalition and the Twin Cities Innovation Alliance Director. Marika, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Marika, you all had a very interesting struggle there in the Twin Cities against a data sharing agreement that was promoted as being a benefit to schools, but had some troubling implications for students, families, and communities. I was wondering if you could tell us some about that and about just what is the cradle to prison algorithm.
Yes, thank you. So we became aware of a joint powers data sharing agreement between Ramsey County, the City of St. Paul, and St. Paul Public Schools. And this agreement had been framed as a way to be more efficient, cost effective, and reach and resource more students and families. What we learned about the process is that they were planning on collecting expansive data that had no prohibition, meaning that they would be collecting this data for an ongoing basis, and they had not identified all the ways that they would be using the data. So that was one issue. The second issue was that they were talking about integrating a tool called predictive analytics, where they design an algorithm to identify students who would be potential risks, or as we like to reframe what they're saying and not use code, is that they are identifying young people as threats. And then the third piece that we really had issue with in this agreement is it created a new governing body that structurally excluded anyone but the elected officials or systems representatives for having oversight to this data. And so those are all critical issues that we had with this thing that emerged. But the origination of this this data sharing agreement was problematic as well. And the community engagement process that they used to get to the determination that they wanted to proceed with an agreement like this. So with the community engagement pieces, we had a number of community members that participated on a Safe Schools Task Force, and there was also Marnita's Table hosted a number of community engagement sessions that dove deep into specific communities of color and different demographic groups. And what people felt that after they had this community engagement, the community came up with these really rich recommendations about how to support schools, how to support youth and students, how to support families, and that those recommendations didn't make it into the report. And they used the report itself of these recommendations for community to compel elected officials and leadership that the community was really invested in this data sharing agreement when it was not the case. And then, to kind of add things to the issue, we started having conversations with more and more people and realized that folks did not really understand what they had agreed to, what they had committed to, and they actually weren't even equipped to have the conversation with the language about what they were trying to accomplish. And so we were able to get them, after a long, drawn-out struggle, to get them to pause.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously, when you have that kind of, faux community engagement that you were talking about, we're just sort of having it as a superficial thing to say that you did it, but to then basically ignore all the proposals from the communities. I mean, it really, calls into question the motivation behind the whole piece itself. So, I mean, what do you all think is really sort of the motive factor, if you will, in trying to have this data sharing agreement?
I think that they were the elected officials and the systems officials were really attracted to that new shiny thing called innovation. This, by definition, is not innovation, but that's what they were selling it as. And so, and I just want to make clear that the recommendations that the community set forward were not included, but that they added their own, the systems folks added their own recommendation, and that was to use the big data predictive analytics piece. So not only did they not listen to the community's recommendations, they actually spoke for them themselves by placing that information into the recommendation without the knowledge or support of the community.
Wow. And, you know, when I saw that, you know, predictive analytics was, you know, going to be used in this piece, you know, that's a worrisome thing. I've seen the same sort of issue pop up specifically in the criminal legal system towards a similar end. And there was a whole point about the racial bias and other sort of biases within these analytics that was a part of the issue as well. And I was wondering if you could break some of those problems down for us.
So you are so right on the point. So the way that I don't have a background in data science or mathematics, statistics, or any of that. The way that I actually came into this work is I work on the school-to-prison pipeline and discipline disparities. And so we've been working with local school districts and the Department of Education and the Department of Human Rights. And last year, the Department of Human Rights identified 43 school districts in the state of Minnesota for discriminating against Black and brown children in subjective out-of-school suspensions. So the intersection with predictive analytics is, as they were selling the predictive analytics, they said, you know, we need to have some indicators that we could use to identify who the resources and supports might go to. And brought me to this work is that they tried to use suspensions as one of the indicators for predictive analytics to say, if you've had a certain amount of suspensions, we will, you'll get a higher number in a risk score assessments that's created through the predictive analytics. And so we looked at the other indicators that they were talking about and how to create a risk assessment, and we realized that bias was baked into it. So how could we even have a fair and just conversation when they did not have the know-how and sense to say, we already have racial inequity in how we do discipline in Minnesota, and now we're going to further deepen that by not just using suspension data, but say a child had an interaction with Child Protection Services or the Public Health and Human Services Department, or not even you, the student, but a family member, a sibling who had interacted with the juvenile justice system. All of these things could potentially be used as indicator to identify a risk score. They would give students risk scores. And all of the indicators, again, have the potential for bias. Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, is the second worst state in the country. We go back and forth with Wisconsin for racial disparity. So it's like we're further perpetuating the school-to-prison pipeline. And we expanded it, came up with the term cradle-to-prison algorithm, because with these new predictive analytics, they're looking at information before a child is born. They're looking at Child Protection Services. They're looking at foster care. So they have access to children's information from the time they're born through the time they determine to stop collecting the data. So it further discriminates and creates further inequities for Black and brown children. So that's just problematic.
Absolutely. And you make an important point when you talk about how there's already, you know, these sorts of issues, these racial disparities within schools and the way that Black and brown students are treated. And this whole data piece just, to your point, seems as though it's going to basically deepen and add sort of a level of criminalization, if I could use that word, on these students. And I can't help but wonder, and I know that there was some, you know, there wasn't a lot of clarity around, you know, accountability and who would have access to some of this and who and what would actually be done with that data. Do we know, like, what is the role of law enforcement in this whole piece, particularly when, you know, there's sort of the points of, you know, the juvenile justice system, like you said, and all these sorts of things. So it just seems as though it's going to put young people and students in a position to brush up against, you know, law enforcement and the criminal legal system even more.
I couldn't agree with you more. So the Coalition to Stop the Cradle to Prison Algorithm is made up of folks that work on the education side and the juvenile justice side of the school to prison pipeline. And they flagged right away in the conversation that law enforcement does not need to have more information about students and families, and that the city of St. Paul has their police department, so they would be a part of this data sharing agreement and have more access to information. The other piece is that when they were talking about convening this governing body that structurally excludes community members, there was a seat that they were considering putting the chief of police on there. And so if we're talking about prevention and upstream services, I do not see any need for any law enforcement to have access to more information to students that are supposed to be protected. They're supposed to have a moat around them so that they can be young people, make mistakes, get second chances, but they're not criminalized in doing so. And in this process, again, I think they're making the assumptions about the students. And so giving information, giving access to law enforcement does nothing to reduce this or fuel the school to prison pipeline.
Yeah, and you know, what I think often gets lost, Marika, in a lot of these sorts of issues and the way that they play out, I think like we saw with this data sharing agreement piece, is that, you know, things that may actually work, you know, as basic as it sounds, sort of get glossed over. And I think that's the importance of that, you know, genuine, legitimate community engagement that we've been talking about. So I'm just curious, from you all's standpoint, what do you see as some sort of, you know, possible critical solutions to, you know, some of these, you know, prevention and other issues that this was supposed to address?
Right. And so, again, I like to reiterate that we want to believe that the architects of this joint powers agreement really did have the community's best interests at heart. They made some bad decisions. Having said that, the things that work, we have been talking about them and recommending them to our system for a long time. And another flag in this JPA is, we don't have enough resources to support what works now, and would this be a redirection of resources to the joint powers agreement and investing more money in the AI and the machine learning than actual people on the ground that are doing the work, building the relationships, and know the community that they're trying to serve? So one of the things that we have consistently talked about is there are programs time and again that have demonstrated successfully working between school communities and families. But again, anytime we see something like that is effective, it's worked, there's not enough resource to scale it, or the trend shifts and they go on to something else, the new shiny thing. So when they're talking about one of the solutions that they suggested by using the predictive analytics and through the risk assessment score, is that they would have social workers or whoever go out and knock on the doors and say, hey, We noticed that your student might be at risk for these things. Here's some resources. Go out and make your family better. So in essence, that is an ineffective method, because if you're sending people out that don't already have existing relationships with families and community members, that can be really offensive. And you haven't been invited into the home. So what we talk about is that there are individuals in the system, there are organizations in the community that have relationships with people that they, quote unquote, want to deem at risk. And so our suggestion is that you invest and scale in those programs, that you build and link better relationships with parents to talk about how to support their young people. And that seems like just a really common sense kind of strategy, but we can't even do that one well yet. And yet now we want to do a mechanized process that identifies, you know, who gets help, how they get help, and who knows about what's going on in their life.
Yeah, you know, there's no substitute really for the kind of relationships that you're describing, Marika. And, I wonder how much of this do you think is connected to, you know, broader systemic issues that face, you know, black and brown students in their communities. I know when I think of similar issues that we have here in Washington, D.C., and we look at, you know, some of our schools, we see, you know, high levels of poverty amongst the students and, you know, other sorts of social issues, things that, you know, are impacting these students before they even step in the doors at the school, which I'm sure you're quite familiar with. And so it seems that some of these broader social issues aren't being addressed as critically as they could be. And it's coming home to roost, if you will, on the children as they're, you know, trying to get their education.
Absolutely. And again, I believe at the heart of this, that's what they were trying to get at. I just think they really bumbled it in the way that they were trying to do it. More broadly, yes, our communities are facing issues, but the problem is that they're targeting the individual young people rather than the systems that perpetuate these inequities. And that is the fundamental flaw of the predictive analytics, is putting the microscope on young people versus the systems that perpetuate these inequities. And the other thing I would say is that while these folks are identifying these students as at risk, if you line up a group of young people and look at each of their life circumstances, the one thing we know is true is your past does not predict your future. And if we go on the basis of your past predicting your future, you might be able to use these risk assessment models. But for me, that is not the case. When I think of my personal experience, when I think of the people that I look around that would have been identified at risk, that they were against all these odds, and yet they were very successful. And no machine can tell us that. And so when I think about what the predictive analytics, what the big data is being used for, it's trying to streamline information, but without the wisdom and knowledge of humanity in application and the removal of bias. So if we really want to look at artificial intelligence, let's kind of flip the script and have it look and dissect and explore and discover what's happening within these systems that continue to perpetuate these inequities that our young people and our families have to navigate through on a daily basis, and still most of the time come out successfully.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And, you know, Marika, if folks are interested in learning more about this work and about the organizations, where can they go to seek some more information?
Certainly. So we do have a Coalition to Stop the Cradle to Prison Algorithm Facebook page, and they're welcome to message to us on that Facebook page, and we will respond. And we also can give you info at tcia.org. Again, that's info at tcia.org. That's the Twin Cities Innovation Alliance. And so if you'd like to get connected, you'd like to learn more, please email us. We are actually working on this locally, but we have identified that this is an emerging trend that is happening all around the country. So we're actually starting to work with communities across the United States. And so if you're one of those individuals that might be interested in digging deeper into their community to find out if something like this exists, please email us at info@tcia.org.
Well, Marika, we really appreciate you being willing to join us here on the show. We're going to have to leave it there for now. We're going to go to a break here on By Any Means Necessary. Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. We'll be back. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.